Hello everyone, this is the Brexit Podcast and I'm your host Jennifer Han. For today's episode, Tim chatted to Sir Richard Packer, who's a former secretary at the Ministry of Agriculture, Fisheries and Food, and who recently wrote a report on how our agricultural policy should function once we leave the EU. They discussed both the positive and negative effects leaving the EU could have on the UK's agricultural industry, its labour supply and subsidies. To get more Brexit-related updates like this in the future, you can subscribe to us wherever you're listening to this podcast. And while you're there, please do rate and review us to share the love. You can also find us at brexitpodcast.com and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Brexit Podcast.
And it's a warm Brexit podcast. Welcome to our next guest, Sir Richard Packer. Welcome to the show, Sir Richard.
Good afternoon.
Thank you. Richard, now I wanted to talk to you about agriculture and agricultural policy, a recent report you just wrote. The National Farmers Union, speaking to them for an earlier episode, they wanted to remain in the European Union. Europe's one of our key exporting regions. How can Brexit be a positive?
It's not certain that Brexit will be a positive for farmers. My paper that you've referred to simply examines the interactions of Brexit, agriculture and agricultural policy, and how one affects the other. And if you analyse it, there are some things that are positive about Brexit for some people and there's some things that are negative. If I could give you an example.
Please.
A positive, it would allow us to simplify the support system, which is widely agreed under the current regime to be over-bureaucratic. If I could give you an example of the negative from a farmer's perspective, one would suspect that without the need to meet CAP rules, the Treasury might have their eyes on some of the subsidies currently paid to farmers, which could end up to farmers' detriment. So it's a very complicated system, a very complicated situation. It's not one that lends itself to simple statements that Brexit will be brilliant for farmers or Brexit will be bad for farmers or the sectors. It's much more nuanced than that. You need to look at the detail.
Okay, so let's have a little look at some of that detail. So I think you're referring there to the Common Agriculture Policy. So as a nation, we pay in an awful lot of money, but then that in theory is redistributed back to us and back to other rural sectors of society. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. And you've hit on almost the only unequivocally good thing about Brexit in this area, which is that at present we pay a large sum of money towards supporting agriculture in other EU member states, essentially because our agricultural sector is relatively small compared to the size of the economy relative to other member states. And so we end up paying a lot to support agriculture elsewhere, and stopping doing so, obviously, will net us several billion pounds a year.
Yeah, but then on the negative side of that, if we're exporting to Europe and they're our biggest market, well, if we come out of the single market and the tariffs suddenly go on produce, that's just going to price farmers out of business, isn't it?
Well, there's something in that, but I don't look at matters that way.
Okay.
The fact of the matter is that in food, drink, and feed, which is the relative category, we export some £17 billion worth a year less to Europe than they export to us. So I see that as giving us, the UK negotiators, a strong hand in that part of the negotiations, because if barriers were put up, the continentals stand to lose more than we do.
I see. Okay, so that can be a positive in that sense. So, you know, you said it was incredibly complicated. Is it possible to do a cost-benefit study of the current lay of the land and what will happen when we leave the European Union?
Well, certainly not at the moment it isn't, because, of course, the government's objectives are shrouded in quite a degree of mist as of this moment. But nevertheless, some things is clear. The fact we're ceasing to pay for agriculture in other member states will be a good thing and worth many billions of pounds. Everything else is depends on the negotiations and what people, not merely where we end up, but also what we ask for. Of course, we haven't actually decided what to ask for, nor do we know, of course, what the Europeans are going to want. Everyone concentrates very much, I notice, in the media on what we're going to ask and we're going to demand, but it takes two to negotiate, and a lot will depend on the negotiating position of the EU27, which will be set out formally by the Commission, presumably when the negotiations start.
Okay, and as an expert in this area then, what do you think the key tenets of what we'll be asking for will be?
Well, I would expect, this is expectation, not certainty, you understand?
Of course, absolutely, yeah. Appreciate nothing certain in the current situation.
I would expect the UK negotiators to start off by saying there's some things we would like to have. I imagine they will start off by saying, you know, if we can't reach an agreement to... you know, it's too bad. I wouldn't expect us to want to seem too eager, but and to step forward a number of things outside the agricultural sector, financial services, for instance, and then I would expect them to draw attention to the large trade deficit we have in manufactured goods and in agricultural goods. Which we've already discussed, and to say, you know, there's a lot of advantages for you there. Were we to agree a free trade system, we'd like some quid pro quo. Then I'd expect the other lot, the Commission, Europeans, to say, well, I don't know about that. And we'd have to see where we got to.
Mm.
So it's by no means simple, and precedent suggests that actually... you normally don't get very far in these negotiations until you get to sort of close to 11:59 at night, metaphorically speaking, and then everything gets a good agreed at the very last minute. That's what the precedent suggests.
When do we think the last minute's going to be, though, in this case? Because there doesn't seem to be a timescale set out, as far as I can make out.
Well, there is a timescale under Article 50. Everything has to be agreed, in theory, within 2 years. Now, that can be extended if everybody agrees, but I'd have thought that two-year period was the was what one would regard as a normal time period.
Mm. Good to know. So, the agriculture, as you said, it's not, for us, it's nowhere near as big a part of our economy as it is for others in Europe. 0.7% of GDP in the UK, a figure that's less than half the EU average.
Yeah. So it's more than twice as important for them as it is for us.
Do you think it's going to become more important when we leave the European Union? I suppose, as a nation, do we become a more subsistence country?
Well, let's hope not. We want to get richer, not poorer. I wouldn't expect to see a radical change in UK agricultural production after Brexit. But you never know what might happen. But I would expect things to proceed much the same as they do now. Of course, if a free trade agreement in agricultural matters were not agreed for any reason...
Yes.
Then there would be a scope for UK producers to expand in some areas because European imports would, in some cases, face large import charges. This wouldn't be to the advantage of consumers, but it might be to the interest of producers. But overall, one would expect good sense on both sides to prevail at the end, and one would expect a free trade deal in agricultural goods and probably industrial goods as well to be agreed. But it's not certain, and it takes two to agree something. It's all very well people saying we've got to agree this, that and the other. If the other side don't want to agree it, it won't be agreed.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Are there particular areas of the agricultural industry that face greater challenges, you know, be that livestock or be that grain or whatever?
Well, I see two particular challenges. One I've already mentioned, which is that I suspect the Treasury will try to reduce the level of subsidies, notably area payments. That I would expect to happen. And then in the longer term, I'm now talking, you know, several years.
Yes.
That people make much of these trade deals we might do with other countries, like the United States, Australia, Brazil, and so on. Now, most of these countries that we will do major trade deals with have substantial agricultural sectors, and they will be looking for agricultural concessions in any deal. So in the longer term, that might give rise to disadvantages for UK agriculture. If, for instance, a deal with Australia or New Zealand included something significant on dairy, which they might want, then that would be to the disadvantage of the UK.
Yes, it seems sort of infeasible that we might be exporting dairy product to Australia and New Zealand.
No, we won't be exporting it, but we might be importing it. And the more we import, if there were a special deal, it could, depending on the details, reduce the UK milk price significantly. So that's a long-term challenge, I would say. Threats, perhaps putting it a bit strongly, but something that might happen in the long run.
Just on your first point, when you know the Treasury, then we stop paying the Common Agricultural Policy, the Treasury gets a little bit more in its coffers, but then it has its hand on that as well. Which areas, sort of geographical areas of the UK, would be most worried by this?
I think it would be fair to say that the worry would be spread through everywhere, because these payments cover arable area. They also cover specialised areas, environmentally sensitive areas and so on, all these special environmental schemes. But also, of course, there are area payments for hill areas, for cattle and sheep. They're not called headage payments anymore, mainly because they're not headage payments. They've been transformed into area payments. But all of these payments I'm not saying it will be, but could be in the Treasury's sight. Quite a lot will depend on the political clout of the Environment Secretary, currently Mrs. Leadsom, against the Treasury. And if the Treasury were to take the line I've suggested they will, which I'm quite confident they will, because they're the Treasury are like an alcoholic; they can't help themselves. You know, when they see public money being spent, they can't resist trying to claw it back.
Yeah. is the free movement of people vital to keep our agricultural sector working properly?
Yes, it is. But I don't see that as a particular problem with Brexit. We can, assuming we're out of the single market and free movement doesn't exist, it would be simple to make a special scheme explicitly for agriculture and perhaps for a couple of other industries. I don't know whether there is a demand for other industries, but to make a special scheme which would meet the immigration criteria and set out the rights of those coming to healthcare and so on. And I think in principle that should be a deal that's easily done, because it's to the advantage of us, and it's to the advantage of the countries where the people come from and of the people themselves. So I don't see that as a problem.
And what about the erosion of production values? Is that going to be an issue for us if we have to produce food cheaper and cheaper to get it onto the world markets?
Well, there isn't that much of UK production, agricultural production as opposed to processed production. Of course, Scotch whisky and gin and all those sort of things have got a big market anyway, and they're fundamentally agricultural products. But with the basic products, there isn't that much of UK production that goes onto the world market at the moment, although, of course, there is some. But, the drive to produce ever more efficiently is always present and will be present whether we're in the European Union or whether we're not. So, I don't see there being any fundamental difference. The drive to efficiency is always there.
And in your report, you also say that it's... the agricultural policy should be one that contributes to environmental aims in terms of both landscape and biodiversity.
Well, I think there is substantial public support, but by substantial, I mean majority public support for those policies, sort of pretty much as we have them at the moment. That, of course, would be the Environment Secretary's retort to the Treasury were they to make the point that I've suggested they will. I think there is a degree of support for the environmental measures we have in place now at pretty much the level we've got them. So I see a lot of public support, and I think there would be strong opposition if the support we've got for the environment, agro-environment at the moment, were to be taken away, or if it were to be suggested they should be radically reduced.
So those with concerns for environmental measures, they should be assuaged, and they should be quite confident that...
They might have to speak up, though.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no good just sitting back and hoping it all works out all right. You need to make clear what your interests are, and I'm sure that the environmental interests will do that.
I guess this is all interlinked with other areas of society. I mean, is it important that we have the financial services sector stays robust, do you feel?
I am not an expert on the financial sector, but I do know that it employs a lot of people and it contributes greatly to GDP, and it's a very important part of our economy, and therefore it's the job of Her Majesty's government to protect it as best they can. And I'm sure that they recognise that themselves.
Okay, and if you had one final message to Richard for those in charge of making sure agricultural policy is in the right place post Brexit, what would that be?
It would be think carefully before you make significant changes to the present arrangements. Once we've stopped paying for agriculture in other EU member states, there's quite a lot to be said for the agricultural policy as it is at the moment. And it would be a mistake, in my view, to make radical changes just for the sake of it.
Okay. So Richard Packer, thanks ever so much for being a guest on the Brexit podcast today.
As always, thanks for listening. And if you enjoy the show, please subscribe to us on your podcast platform of choice so you'll be notified whenever we upload a new episode and you'll be able to tune in. In the meantime, you can find us at brexitpodcast.com and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Brexit Podcast. The show is produced by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming, and Warren Paul, and our theme song is Cool Vibes by Kevin MacLeod.